Welcome to Work Matters, where we explore what leaders can do to make work more productive, valuable, meaningful, and impactful. I am your host, Thomas Bertels.
In today's episode of Work Matters, we will talk about visual leadership. And my guest is Todd Churches. Todd is the CEO of Big Blue Gumball, a leadership development executive coaching firm. He is also a member of Marshall Goldsmith's prestigious MG 100 coaches. He was recognized by Thinkers50, Thinkers 360, and the Powerlist 200 as a leading management expert. He is an award-winning professor and lecturer at NYU and Columbia University. And last but not least, he is the author of Visual Leadership, Leveraging the Power of Visual Thinking in Leadership and in Life. In our discussion, we'll explore what visual leadership is and why it matters, how leaders can utilize visual leadership tools and frameworks to make work more meaningful and productive, how leaders can become more effective at giving feedback, and why providing employees with autonomy is critical to increase engagement and foster innovation. I hope you enjoy this conversation, and please don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Thomas. Great being with you.
So you're an expert on visual leadership. So ground us, what is visual leadership and why does it matter?
Visual leadership is basically the application of visual thinking and visual communication to the practice of leadership. And what is visual thinking? It's about thinking in pictures, right? It's about using visual language, visual imagery to paint a picture with words, to create a mental movie in the minds of others. And the goal is to get people to see what we're saying. So that's like the most basic foundational way to explain what visual leadership is all about.
Excellent. So our focus here, right, as I said, is what leaders can do to make work better, right? More meaningful, more motivating for people. And we know that intrinsically motivated people are more productive, right? They stay longer, they're more engaged. So your book has a host of tools. I didn't count them, but there's a ton of really interesting tools. Maybe you could talk to us about how our listeners can use some of the tools that you introduce in the book to make work better.
We all want to get the best and the most out of people. I always say that managers try to get the most out of people, leaders try to get the best out of them, right? So there's a slight subtle distinction between the most and the best. If you're always just trying to wring people dry and get the most out of them, they get burnt out, right? If you're trying to get the best out of people by doing what's best for them, then that's a more positive. That's how you build engagement. That's how you build passion and purpose, right? So that's what we're trying to do as leaders, and these tools will help us to do that. I break it down into four categories. Category one is using visual imagery, and that can include pictures, props, drawing, anything that you could take in through the eye. Category two is using mental models and frameworks. And we all know a lot of Maslow's hierarchy of needs as an example, or a four-box matrix, or a stepladder, anything, any kind of framework that will help you to take the complexity and messiness and try to compartmentalize and try to wrap our heads around things to simplify complexity. Category three is using metaphors and analogies to explain something by using something else that's familiar to help make the invisible visible. And category four is using storytelling with bonus points for humor if and when appropriate. Because people, when you use humor, when you lighten the mood, people are more engaged. You know, even though we're dealing with serious business, you need to find the humor in people, in relationships. And when you do that, you're more innovative, you're less stressed, you don't burn out as quickly. So those are basically the four buckets that I usually talk about.
So one of the tools I really love in your book is the passion skill matrix. Can you tell us what that is and how leaders can use that?
Sure. Visually, I would love to be able to draw it or sketch it, but I'm going to have to paint a picture with words. So doing it verbally, right? So picture a four-box matrix, and there's two components. One is your passion and one is your skill. So for any task, you would say, all right, on a scale of 1 to 10, what is my passion level for this task? Do I hate it? Is it okay? Or do I love it? So it's from I hate it to I love it. And your skill level is from I'm terrible at it to I'm amazing at it. So those are the two dimensions, right? So the upper right box is your sweet spot. When what you do and your skills and your passions are in alignment, time flies by, work flows, you're in your element, whatever you want to call it, that's your sweet spot, right? That's what you're getting. That's what you're known for and known as. So I always say to people, what do you want to be known as the go-to person for or the guru of? What are you a subject matter expert in? That's your sweet spot. So that's the upper right box. The upper left is your growth zone. Those are things that you may have an interest in or a passion for, but you're not great at it yet. It's not in your sweet spot. It may be you're okay, or maybe you're working towards it. But if something's in your growth zone and you have an interest and a passion, you're more likely to put the time and effort into improvements and reading and working and practicing and getting coaching and feedback and improving. So I always say, and Carol Dweck is the master of this, the power of yet, right? It's not that I'm not good at it. It's that I'm not good at it yet. So just when you add that word yet, it adds the potential to be good at something down the road. And I have numerous examples for all of these. The lower right box is your default zone. That's where you're good or great at something, but you don't like it or love it, but you just do it on autopilot by default because that's who you are and what you're known for. And the final box, the lower left, is your failure zone. You're not good at it and you don't like it and you feel stuck there. So those are basically, in a nutshell, the four boxes. And none of us are born into the sweet spot, right? We all start somewhere in the failure zone or the growth zone, but we could turn a failure into a growth zone by learning and development. And then you turn something into a sweet spot over time as you master it, as you get better at it. But also, if you keep doing something for too long and you don't keep your skills and your attitude and your passions up, it could drop into the default zone. And if you're really complacent, you could find yourself sliding into the failure zone. So what's interesting about this model is, even though it's a four-box matrix, it really is a cycle. So I'll stop there for a second. But what were your thoughts? Like, what resonates about that model with you? I'm curious.
Well, I could picture, right, besides like the individual application, right, as a leader, and you say, right, let me look at my own work. I think it's a really useful conversation starter to engage the people that report into you,
yeah,
right, and get an understanding of, right, are there tasks that, right, nobody is particularly good at and nobody particularly cares about? And maybe that's an opportunity, right, to offload that task, to have more, I guess, in the mix of things that people enjoy doing or that allow people to grow, right? So I thought it was a really, I think, interesting framework to just be able to start a dialogue, right, and get everybody on the same page.
Yeah, what I found is when people are disengaged in their job, it tends to be because they're spending a lot of their time below the line in the default and the failure zones. Ideally, you want to spend 70% or more of your time above the line in the growth zone. There's always parts of our job that we don't love or that we just have to do because we're the only one. But if that's your job every day for, you know, 40 hours a week, you're not going to be engaged. You're not going to be motivated. And like you were saying, someone else's growth zone could be something in your default zone, and maybe you could pass some of those. So that's when I do this with teams, we have everyone do their passion skill matrix. We lay them all out and we figure out how can we redistribute roles and responsibilities or get people the training or coaching they need to help them get out of those, the default and the failure zone, and get them into the zones where they're going to be most productive and most engaged. So it's a powerful tool when used individually or collectively with a team.
Yeah, there's another tool you have, which I love. It's the R&R tool. And a spoiler alert, right? It doesn't stand for roles and responsibilities, as I initially thought, or rest and relaxation. But what does it stand for?
Yeah, I always say the rest and relaxation comes after you've gotten your roles and responsibilities done. But it stands for resources and roadblocks. If you're a manager and you delegate something to someone, if you don't give them the resources that they need, financial, technology, human resource, whatever it is, if you don't equip them and set them up for success, they're going to fail. And the second part of that is, what are the roadblocks that stand in the way, and what as a manager can you do to help remove some of those roadblocks? So if you use American football as an example, you're trying to block and create a hole so when you hand someone the ball, they could run through the hole and get a touchdown, right? But so often, managers will delegate, but they will not give people the resources. They do not help them by removing the roadblocks. And then they wonder why people get stuck, right? So that's a good reminder. The R&R is a good reminder that, are you setting your people up for success or failure?
Obviously, in your work, you're dealing with leaders. You try to help them become more effective. Leadership is all about, right, guiding people. You can only be a leader if you have followers, right? And the followers also want to get something out of it, right? What's your theory about what people want to get out of work?
Yeah, when I teach about engagement and motivation, I tend to go back to some of the classic models like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? So people want to have their survival and safety and security needs met. Then they want to feel a part of a team, right? The social community aspect. You want to feel like you're significant and making a contribution. That's level four. And then that feeling of self-actualization, that when who you are and what you do are in alignment, right? So people, Maslow, you know, told us that back in the 1960s, right? Or even earlier. So people want and need that. In Drive, Dan Pink's terrific book on motivation, he talks about autonomy, mastery, and purpose, right? People want the freedom to do the job in the way that works best for them. Mastery is about learning, growth, and development. People want to feel like they're moving forward and developing. And then purpose, people want to feel that their work matters. You know, and I always think about that classic story about the two bricklayers. One, you ask, what are you doing? He said, I'm laying bricks. And the other one says, I'm building a cathedral or a hospital or a school, right? So one, they're both laying bricks, but one's approaching their work with a sense of passion and purpose. And I think that is what people want and need. Otherwise, you're just checking the box and you're just showing up. And that's where people get disengaged. And that's where you get the quiet quitting and everything. But as leaders, we need to have a vision that is inspiring. And we need to communicate that vision in a clear and compelling way. And then we need to set our people up for success and instill in them that sense of passion and purpose. You know, people say, oh, you always seem so excited about talking about this stuff. And I am, because I love it, because I've had so many horrible bosses that if people learn how to lead better, we will make the world a better place and create better jobs by creating a better workforce, a better workplace. So that's why I'm passionate about it. But I think that's what leaders need to do, is to meet people where they live and to set them up for success and be, I always say A&E, you know, have a positive attitude and enthusiasm.
One of the things I really enjoyed in the book is also, I think, your description of your first job, right? I guess it was in Hollywood or Hollywood adjacent. Maybe, if you don't mind, recount the experience and what it gave you, what it provided you with.
Yeah, it was one of my jobs earlier in my career in Hollywood. I was working for a psychotic boss who was very insecure and incompetent. And I tried to do my best job, but whatever I did wasn't good enough. And the chapter is called A Love Letter to Horrible Bosses. And I always repost it every Valentine's Day as a blog post. So I'll be posting it on LinkedIn in a couple of weeks for Valentine's Day. But basically, my boss threw a box of pens at my head because they were not the pens that she wanted. So when I'm teaching feedback in my classes, I say to my students, let's say your employee ordered the wrong pens. Is there any other way of giving them the feedback that they ordered the wrong thing? Like, nope, throwing it at their head. That's the only way that they're going to learn. Right? So it's But when you've worked for people like that who are abusive and you know, it's not fun, and that's how you get people to be disengaged and feel underappreciated and abused, and that's when they either quiet quit or they leave.
Yeah. You just mentioned feedback, and you offer a number, I think, of interesting concepts in your book relative to feedback. How can leaders become more effective at giving feedback?
If the waiter comes over and says, how was dinner tonight? And you say, well, the food was good. The music was too loud. Yeah, that's feedback, right? So we give feedback all the time. It's just that we don't always do it well, right? We don't always do it effectively. I love Marshall Goldsmith's concept from What Got You Here Won't Get You There, where he talks about feed forward, right? You can change the past, right? So it's valuable and helpful to have information about the past, but feed forward is like, what can we do differently or better in the future, right? We can't. So many leaders hit people over the head with what went wrong, but that, you know, maybe you learned from it, maybe you didn't. A lot of times it destroys their morale and it has all kinds of negative implications if you don't do it well. So I talk about five different types of feedback. So when you're giving feedback, what type are you giving? Sometimes it's just highlighting, hey, great job. Other times it's developmental, hey, great job. And not but and next time try this, it might be even better. It could be corrective, like this is what went well, but this is what didn't. Let's see how we could fix this for next time. The next time type is corrective, where it's like, this can't happen again. And disciplinary is like, all right, you really screwed up. We need to talk, right? So those are five different types. So when you're giving feedback, there's nothing wrong with saying, hey, great job. In fact, that's a great thing, but you don't know what you did well or not. So that developmental piece of and, you know, this is what you did well and here's what you could do better or differently next time. That's where feedback is really most helpful. And there's all different techniques for doing that. But that's something to think about as a leader. Are you giving feedback regularly? And are you doing it well, right? Effectively.
Yeah. I think another word you used earlier, right, when we talked about Maslow's hierarchy of needs and so forth, is the topic of autonomy, which we know is a driver
of helping employees experience their work as motivating. What comes to mind with regards to autonomy?
There's the quote from Jim Collins in his book, Good to Great, where he said, don't discipline people, hire self-disciplined people, and then turn them loose within the framework of accountability. So often we hire people and say, this is what I want you to do, and this is how I want you to do it. You're making people feel like a robot or a marionette or a puppet, right? If you say, this is what we need done, how do you think we should do it? And it becomes a dialogue and a conversation. That's how things go best, because what works for someone else may not work for you or vice versa. And I think it was Patton who said, never tell people how to do things, tell them what needs to get done, and they'll amaze you with their ingenuity. And I love that philosophy because it empowers people. It gives people a sense of ownership. Otherwise, people feel like they're just, again, checking the boxes, and that's how you destroy people's sense of passion and purpose. You're not allowing them to be creative or innovate or find new or better ways of doing things.
One of the things I find fascinating is leaders in their own role put a high emphasis on doing something that has a purpose, that has a meaning, that they demand autonomy. The same rules don't seem to apply for the rest of the organization further down.
And then they wonder why people are disengaged, or they're just showing up, or quiet quitting, or real quitting, right? So it's like everyone needs that. That's just a basic human need. And I was just reminded of the Steve Jobs quote. He said that we don't hire smart people so that we could tell them what to do. We hire smart people so that they could tell us what to do, right? So one of the key traits of a good leader is just being a good listener. You know, Peter Drucker talked about that. I mean, all the great management gurus talk about the importance and value of listening with an open mind, with empathy and compassion. When we do 360s, listening tends to be the thing that CEOs score themselves the highest in, but their people score them the lowest in. So I would say the biggest gap on these surveys is between the ears, because just no one's listening, right? So we need to filter that listening down to all levels of the organization, especially the people who are interacting with customers, right? People in the C-suite make huge strategic decisions about a company without knowing what's going on out there in the field or what's going on out there in their store or whatever. It's like they're losing that customer touch point. And I think it's so important to listen and have the information flow upward and downward in the organization.
Yeah. So as I said, like, your book has a ton of great tools and stories. What are your favorite tools and stories in the book? Do you have any favorites?
Well, one of the ones I was just about to mention was, I always talk about three Vs: visibility, voice, and value, right? People want to be seen, people want to be heard, and people want to make a contribution and get recognition for that contribution, right? One of the challenges in today's hybrid world is the proximity bias of giving favoritism to the people who are in the office, but often neglecting or forgetting about the people who are working remotely or working from home or working in a satellite office. So I think that's important too, is to give people an opportunity for that visibility, voice, and value so that they feel seen, they feel heard, they feel like their contributions are being valued and recognized. That's something that in a hybrid world, we need to make a little more effort, because the old style MBWA, managing by walking around, you can't do that as a manager if you're walking around your office and no one's at their desk because they're working from home that day, right? So I think in managing and leading in the post-pandemic world is one of the biggest challenges. And that's what we talk about in my leadership classes at NYU and Columbia. That's one of the biggest challenges with all my coaching clients, because all the rules have changed, expectations have changed. So we need to figure out, how do we navigate this new global diverse workforce where everyone has different needs? And so it takes a little more effort to do that. So some of the tools in my book, help us to do that and just to think differently and make decisions more effectively.
Wonderful. It was a real pleasure, right, reading your book and learning about your work. People, I think, that are looking for coaching support would be well advised to seek out your services.
Thank you.
We'll include in the show notes information about where people can learn more about your book and about your work. But for now, I wanted to say thank you so much for coming on the show and for sharing your perspective on visual leadership and how people can use some of the tools in your book to make work better.
Thank you. Thank you, Thomas. I appreciate it. We have a lot of synergies. We're both trying to fix work, right? We're trying to make a dysfunctional workplace more efficient and more effective and more engaging and more inspiring for people. So it's always great talking to you and collaborating with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this discussion. If you did, be sure to subscribe, like, share, or comment. Until next time, let's make work matter.